I wanted to start now. Colleagues, as I understand, while I was gone, Paul Warner passed out excerpts of an article from Governing Magazine relating to, was it Oregon and Washington? Was that it?
Oregon, Washington.
For those of you who get governing at your office, I'd commend that to you to read cover to cover. It analyzes all 50 states with in the same vein, dealing with issues of adequacy and fairness and tax administration. And then there are other several other articles just of general interest about the current nature of the state budget situation around the country. And I don't know if you don't get that delivered to your office, I think that's all online as well. I'd commend it to you. It makes for a pretty sobering but also very helpful reading. And for those of you who care, and I think in this committee we do, I was in Washington this week, and the folks who I heard from the director of the National Governors Association and the director of the State Budget Officers and Karina Eckel from NCSL, the message from them was that for the states, just speaking at a macro level, the budget picture for 2003-04 looks like it's going to be worse than the picture for the current budget year. So they're still looking at more troubled times ahead. So tighten those belts and be prepared for some more rough sailing. With that, we will get back to some good principal issues. Last week we heard from the business community on the matter of a relationship between tax policy and economic development and job growth. We've invited labor representatives today for their perspective, and Chuck Sheketoff from the Oregon Center for Public Policy as well. Just a different perspective on pretty much the same issue, how revenue policy impacts our economy in the private sector. So with that, let's bring up Chuck, if you want to begin. We'll have the same kind of panel discussion today as we had last Friday, and appreciate your participation.
Get my notes ready here. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Chuck Sheketoff, Executive Director of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. The center uses research and analysis to advance policies and practices that improve the economic and social prospects of low and moderate income Oregonians, the majority of Oregonians. I've had staff distribute to you a few items. The first is our biennial look at the state of the economy from the perspective of working Oregonians, boom, bust, and beyond, which I'll be referring to a little bit today. A report that's about a year old. We're hoping to update it because the new census data is out on taxes and spending analysis of the census data called Things Don't Look Different Here. It essentially shows that we haven't changed over time and that we're not much different than a lot of other states. A report we issued during the election cycle in response to a proposal that came up during the elections, a couple of proposals that came up from both candidates for governor with regard to cutting the capital gains tax and why that would be bad for Oregon's economy. A two-page summary of the Institute on Taxation Economic Policy's most recent analysis of our tax system. You'll see the graph is very similar, and the numbers are very similar to the OTIM numbers. This is non-elderly taxpayers is one of the difference is, but it's, you'll see it's very similar. And then last but not least is a little envelope stuffer on low-income tax credits that the legislature has enacted and improved upon, and the earned income credit I know is on the agenda to look at for improving as well. We will be distributing this, I think, early next week to the legislature with to the full legislature with lots of copies, and we have thousands of them literally, for you to include in your letters to constituents. I anticipate when we distribute that, we will also be telling you how many people in your district apply. We estimate utilize the federal earned income tax credit. It'll give you a sense of the extent of working poor in your district. I'm going to begin by giving a quote from a former IRS commissioner, Sheldon Cohen. He said this about taxation. People think taxation is a terribly mundane subject, but what makes it fascinating is that taxation, in reality, is life. If you know the position a person takes on taxes, you can tell their whole philosophy. The tax code, once you get to know it, embodies all the essence of life: greed, politics, power, goodness, and charity. I think as you go through the rest of the session, you'll realize that. Before going into our sort of priorities and recommendations of what you ought to do and ought not to do this session, I wanted to give it a little bit of context. And that's why I gave you copies of Boom, Bust, and Beyond. There's been some amnesia in Oregon about the extent to which the economy in Oregon grew, this talk of we need to open our doors to business. The doors never closed. Oregon's economy was one of the fastest growing economies in the country. From 19, the GSP growth, gross state product growth, beat the national average every year from 1988 through 2000. From 95 to 2000, we had the fastest growth in the product. In the 1990s, our economy created 385,000 jobs, which is 2.8% annually. We were the 10th fastest growth in jobs in the country. Our population increased by 20%. It was the 11th fastest growth. And a couple weeks ago, it was in the paper that even during the downtime and now slow recovery, we're still having growth in population. Oregon's been open for business, is open for business, has always been open for business. The economy was very good in the 1990s, and workers did have gains in the late gains, and earnings increased from the late 70s. Averages income went up, but median income is still below where it was in the late 70s. Poverty, however, the economy did not help all. Our report 2 years earlier was called Prosperity and Perspective, and it started that discussion, and it's continued in Boom, Bust, and Beyond. The economy, people who were poor in Mississippi benefited more from the boom of the 90s than people who were poor in Oregon. We did not reduce poverty. We also have, if you look at poverty among working families with children, it went from about 5% in the late 70s to 11% in the late 1990s. Over a 20-year period, it doubled the rate of poverty among working families with children. Oregon also had a tremendous growth in income inequality. If you look at table 310 on page 38 of Boom, Bust, and Beyond, you'll see that we had one of the fastest growth in income inequality, second only to Connecticut, which is one of the wealthiest states in the country. And if you look at figure 3.8 on page 37, I'm describing it correctly, you'll see that at the bottom of that graph, median income did not change much from the late 70s through 2000, while the top 1% had tremendous gains. It's not the bottom of the graph, it's the bottom plotting of median income. And you had to use that scale because of the tremendous growth in the top 1%. Those are folks who have an average income of about $800,000. So the distributional effect is also different than it was. We are less progressive. The ITEP report that I gave you, the two-page color graphs, shows that over a 10-year period, low-income Oregonians, if you look on the second page, saw their tax burden rise, while upper-income Oregonians saw their tax burden go down. That's despite the earned income tax credit enacted in the mid-1990s because it's so small.
Chuck, if I can just ask you about that, this doesn't factor in, obviously, though, the working refundable working family child care tax credit.
Right, because that's only used by some taxpayers. So I don't believe it's factored in.
But also because it wouldn't have been effective in the years that you're comparing.
Well, it would have been. No, it was the working family tax credit actually was enacted in 1997 and did go right into effect. It got improved last
session.
Right,
that's what I mean. The refundable aspect of it becomes effective this year.
Refundable comes effective tax year 2003. That's correct. But it does include the EIC. So over time, the bottom 20% saw their income go, their tax burden go up, while the top, in the next two quintiles, it declined. Top two quintiles declined. The other thing I think it's important to put into perspective is our revenue situation, which have been struggling with for some time. And what Oregon suffered from is not a spending problem, it's a revenue shortfall. The revenue projection that you relied upon in creating a budget in May of 2001 was off by about $2 billion. We have a revenue shortfall. The Oregon legislature and, frankly, Oregonians were drunk on an inflated stock market and acted as if the business cycle had been repealed and would not go, we'd never have a return to it. However, economists have bumper stickers that say business cycles happen. And this isn't just liberal economists or government economists, it's people like Cascade Policy Institute's chair of the board, president of the board, Bill Connerly, in 1996, said to the governor, Kitzhaber, don't spend the kicker. And he said to the legislature, don't give it away as a tax cut, sock it away in a rainy day, because rainy days happen. And when you look into lean years and fat years, 96 might have been a fat year, but a lean year is going to come, and it'll be very difficult to cut budgets, as all of you know. So what happened was we didn't save for a rainy day, which we should have, and we acted as if the business cycle was never going to end, and we got caught $2 billion short with tremendous needs in education, human services, public safety, higher education, and the like. And that's the problem we have. And that brings me to our recommendations for your agenda for the 2003 legislative session. I'll use singular session because I hope it is. I think, you know, the news of the revenue forecast may be going down, I think is not surprising. I think you need to protect the base on so you don't have to come into special sessions. On Measure 28, one of my arguments in support of it was not only did it provide money for this current cycle, stop $310 million worth of cuts, but it provided the only guaranteed source of $412 million of new money for the next budget cycle. And probably to the not supported perhaps by colleagues in the human service and education and other communities, I was arguing that perhaps that 412 ought to be put into the ending balance so that you don't have to come into special sessions. The $21 million ending balance, I believe it is in the governor's budget, is they round off to less than that. I trust me on that one. And in a $10 billion budget. And you need to be ready for that. So the rules for the 2003 legislature that I would hope you would follow, and then the specifics. Do no harm, protect the revenues, and solve a long-standing and worsening problem. The top priority of this committee, and it ought to be have moved already and ought to move this next week, is reverse the 1997 decision to do automatic reconnect. I hope the chair and others reserve the right to be wiser tomorrow and recognize that it's more important to maintain control of our tax system and not give that to Congress. It costs us money. And if you do that now and connect to the December 31, 2002, you need a simple majority because you're not raising anyone's taxes. And that bill should be moving, and it should be moving right away. It's the Oregon Tax Freedom Act. It's the Take Back Control of Our Tax System Act. It's to take it away from Congress. Because the proposals that the president has proposed and other things that may happen could cost us dearly and throw you right back into special sessions, much much more than the bonus depreciation. That was sort of peanuts compared to some of the proposals pending in Congress. You know, Dick Munn, if you invite him, was around when the legislature did the constitutional amendment allowing automatic reconnect. And I was at the meeting with Paul Warner of the Governor Kitzhaber's Tax Policy Group when he heard that the 97 legislature did that. And he said, why? We learned that was a mistake. We did that. We started doing automatic reconnect. Then Congress acted on a depreciation thing. We ended it. And they went back to every 2 years deciding which congressional changes you want to adopt, which ones you don't, which ones you want to change. That's good government. That protects the base. You ought to do it ASAP. And that leads to the next issue, which is the inheritance tax. One of the reasons you have a bill on the inheritance tax is because the 1999 legislature neglected to review the changes in the 1997 and 1998 to the inheritance tax. Now, who knows why there was such neglect by the 99 legislature, some of you were here. All I can tell you is the revenue committees did not have a reconnect bill. They didn't have staff going through all the federal tax code changes, and as mundane as that is, and telling you which ones to connect to, and so they missed the inheritance one. And the inheritance tax we do not and cannot do automatic reconnect on. Then in 2001, you didn't have an automatic reconnect, and you actually got a memo about the 2001 changes to the inheritance tax, and you did nothing, which was fine because we didn't think you should adopt those changes. They're unworkable. And it would hurt the public's coffers, and they're bad public policy. And what happened? The Revenue Department and tax practitioners acting upon it, there may be some estoppel claims if the PLF, Public Professional Liability Fund, gets a claim, acted as if the 97 changes had been adopted in 99. They didn't recognize your neglect. your predecessors neglected in your former lives. And so now we have a problem where some estates were settled at too little money, and there's been uncertainty. They didn't discover this until late 2001 or 2002, and we've got a problem. So the agency has a bill to fix that in favor of the taxpayer, which makes sense, by adopting the 1997 as amended in 98 changes for all deaths prior to December 31, 2002. But their bill, however, would then, as of January 1 of this year, take us back to the pre-97 law, the current law in Oregon. I think that's wrong. We ought to modify the estate tax, I think, but we should protect it. It provides about $90 million to Oregon biennium, and that's going to go up with a tremendous transfer of wealth in the years ahead. Yesterday I had the wonderful pleasure of spending about 6 hours with Bill Gates Sr. And Chuck Collins, who just authored a book, Wealth in Our Commonwealth, about why, and they're the two who sort of organized the billionaire backlash to the repeal of the estate tax. The estate tax repeal has been pushed by a few very wealthy families, such as the Gallo family of Gallo Wine, and most people think that it ought to be repealed, and most people think it will impact them. It won't. It's almost equal to the Monty, it's almost as good as the Monty Python tax. Monty Python tax, of course, is the best tax. It's the tax on foreign nationals living outside the country. The inheritance tax taxes just 2% less, and in Oregon, it was 424 estates were taxed in 2000. Nationally, when you hear from NFIB and others that big businesses are going to go under, all big myth. 1 year, I think the most. I think these are 99 data I could find out for you. 47,000 estates, federal estate tax forms, only 700 had closely held business assets as the majority of assets. It's not cutting down businesses. It's going up. The exemption in the federal law actually goes up before it now goes up to $3.5 million. I think you should choose an exemption amount that's reasonable. I think you should make sure you're using the provisions in current federal law that allow farms and businesses to essentially escape it. But we need to have the inheritance tax. And let's put it in perspective. The inheritance tax, as you know, when you transfer the property, the wealth, has what's called stepped-up basis. The person inheriting it, if I had $1,000 of stock and the chair was inheriting it in Microsoft and it's now worth $10 million, he gets it at $10 million when he inherits it from me. If he sells it tomorrow when the market goes up for $11 million, he's only taxed on $1 million. So there was $10 million that escaped the capital gains tax. That stepped-up basis, according to the Oregon Tax Expenditure Report, is costing us about $400 million a biennium. $400 million because of the stepped-up basis. And that's a good thing to have, the stepped-up basis. But when you put the offset that against the $90 million we get from the inheritance tax, it shows that this is not taxing people to death after death. So I would maintain the inheritance tax. It's too important. Fix the problem, but maintain it. Don't send another bill that repeals it to Governor Kulongoski. Next, on the Do No Harm, I've given you a copy of the report, as I mentioned, on capital gains. We do not need to do a capital gains tax. It benefits those who benefited the most in the economy of the 1990s. We've done just fine with it's the best player on our team. You know, some of the talk about getting rid of the capital gains taxes. Well, we have volatility. If we get rid of it, we'll have a more predictable base. I think sadly, this may be true with the Blazers. It's sort of like taking a mediocre team, with one sporadic good star, and firing that star so you can better predict the mediocrity of the team. And Rasheed Wallace, that's the Rasheed Wallace one. Anyway, the capital gains tax is a good tax. It's a fair tax, and it will do nothing at a state level to encourage investment in Oregon by getting rid of it. It's a bad proposal, and I hope you will restrain attempts to change the capital gains tax. And it totally messes up the distribution of our tax system because of who benefits. We do have a paper. We have some data in that report. You have early about. Last spring, there was a proposal. We didn't have a name on it, so we just had a proposal circulating among legislators that LRO did an analysis of. We didn't want to name names in our paper, actually. And it was a proposal to have a capital gains tax cut, put in a sales tax that was broad-based on services, had a low-income tax credit, a refundable large earned income credit, and a change in the tax rates. And what it did was we called it the worst of both possible worlds. It raised taxes on low-income Oregonians and lowered it on upper-income Oregonians, and ended up losing revenue for the state. Which gets to my fourth point, which is under the third rule, which is fix a long-standing problem. OTIM continues to show, the ITEP model shows, that the lowest-income Oregonians have the highest overall burden in Oregon. When you account for the federal offset, which we ought to account for because we're an income and property tax state. And where you need the way to fix that, the most targeted way to start addressing that, is by expanding our meager 5% earned income credit and making it refundable. If it's not refundable, the lowest income people don't get the benefits of the expansion. And it ought to be expanded and made refundable and start addressing the long-standing problem in our tax system that the lowest income Oregonians are having that impact. The next issue on helping shore up the base is the corporate minimum tax. The corporate minimum tax was set in 1929 at $25. In 2000, and then the market crashed. And the 1931 legislature was just as benevolent as this and all in between, and it lowered it to $10. And it's been at $10 since 1931. If the $25 figure was inflated today, it would be about $260. Two-thirds of Oregon's C corporations pay the $10 minimum tax. I can assure you that the Department of Revenue's cost for reviewing those tax filings to see whether or not they're good, they're right, they're done correctly, has gone up since 1931 or 1929. The corporate minimum tax ought to be increased, at least to inflation, if not an alternative type of minimum tax like the business activities tax. And I don't know all the details of it, Mr. Chairman, but I know that New Jersey has a different way of an alternative minimum tax where they're saying, figure it out under our corporate tax system, figure out this sort of business activity and profit and business activity tax, the greater of the two you pay. And that's one of the ways New Jersey met their fiscal crisis in 2002. We ought to have a corporate minimum tax that brings in more money. S corporations, it's essentially a filing fee for their K-1, because the S corporation files a K-1, and then the individual takes the K-1 and on their personal return. I actually think the $10 filing fee for the K-1 ought to go up as well. The price for them to file that, physically file the K-1, whatever they're doing with it, has gone up since 1929. And so we can raise some quick revenue that way, bringing us into the 21st century from pre-Depression era. And that leads to my last issue, which is corporate tax disclosure. At the federal level, Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy is able to go through SEC and other filings to show the extent to which corporations with profits don't pay taxes. And in fact, their studies have shown many don't. It was Enron, from 1996 to 2000, the parent of Portland General Electric, received a net tax rebate of $381 million, $278 of which was in 2000 alone, while over the same period, their profit before federal taxes totaled $1.785 billion. If you have corporate tax disclosure, we'll see who those two-thirds of the companies are. We'll see whether Oregon businesses are at a disadvantage or advantage compared to out-of-state businesses doing business here. The issue is, it's clear that there's a lot of businesses who aren't paying taxes, not only on the minimum tax. You look at what Associated Oregon Industries asked you to do a favor and introduce the research and development tax credit. It's the Tax Freedom Act, the 20-year Tax Freedom Act. They have a 20-year carry forward in their proposal. They're asking you to say, we will exempt from taxes for at least 19 years some businesses. Why would they want a 20-year carry forward? Because they don't pay taxes, regardless of whether the research or development was successful at creating a single job in Oregon. And it's just obscene, the carry forward that they're proposing, they're asking you to adopt, because they just don't pay taxes. I think it's important that we know their corporations exist at the pleasure of this legislature. They're not people. And we can find out what they pay, just like you can find out what individuals pay in property taxes if you do the county-by-county research. But we ought to know what they pay in state taxes and see whether Oregon businesses are an advantage or disadvantage, see whether we're treating similar corporations the same. The federal study shows that, like, GE and Westinghouse have which arguably are similar companies, have very different ultimate tax burdens, or I think even more similar in the pharmaceutical industry, Merck and their competitors, very different tax burdens. We ought to see whether, for instance, Roth's IGA markets, independent grocer markets here in the Valley, are at a disadvantage to Albertsons or Safeway or some of the other national companies. And that you would only know. It also adds to making it a more fair discussion. If a business person is up here telling you that this is an unfair increase in my taxes, the corporate minimum tax, or anything, you don't know whether that person pays taxes or not. And you don't know anything about it. The state revenue department knows, and your staff has authority to know, but you can't know that. And so you can't even test the new rule on being honest up here. And so it's not a new rule, the reminder. A good reminder at that, actually. And so I just think it's important to do. I think it would not harm our business climate. I don't. Those who complain about it, I guess maybe they're not good citizens. Maybe Adidas would see Nike doesn't pay taxes and they've moved their home office here. I don't know, but let's find out. And at that, I'll leave it at that and answer any questions you may have.
Questions of the committee? Representative Barnett?
Yeah, let's see if I can get to the question. Okay. I'll try not to take very long at it. You have obviously a very, very different view of the effects of taxes on the economy, or at least there's a suggestion that you do in what you say. In the presentation you've made, you haven't talked much about that issue, and I wonder if you'd have some comments about that.
Sure. Good question. A couple days ago, the Business Journal reported Freightliner switched to cost 160 jobs at its to a contractor at Active USA. Freightliner was one of the companies that convinced the 2001 legislature to do the super sales factor. They wanted the single sales, which is supposed to encourage manufacturing and jobs here for companies that have primary sales outside the state, like Freightliner, Nike, Adidas, and the like. It doesn't protect jobs. Just yesterday, I received an email about San Antonio, Texas, just got the Toyota pickup truck factory. San Antonio was not the high bidder in tax breaks. Other cities in the South had higher bids. But they chose, if you read the two articles, and I'd be happy to provide this to the committee, that if you read the two articles, you'll see that they chose San Antonio for two business reasons. Infrastructure, they had a rail line, and the government agreed to improve the rail line service to them, like we have in Portland, to a better rail line. And that's where the pickup market is. Number one pickup market is Texas. And they want to get that market, and they want to be close to it. And they chose San Antonio, and actually did not take all the tax breaks San Antonio offered, because they want, for those business reasons. Former U.S. Secretary of U.S. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, in his confirmation hearing, said, "I have never made an investment decision based on the tax code. If you are giving away money, I will take it. If you want to give me inducement for something, I'm going to do it anyway. I will take it. But good business people do not do things because of inducements." Or, to really show you that taxes don't matter, I'll read you this from the Seattle Times regarding Amazon.com. "Seattle-based Amazon has racked up billions of dollars in sales since it went public in 1997, but has only had one profitable quarter. Last year, spokesman Bill Curry said Amazon paid $4 million in state B&O taxes, business and occupation taxes. Had Jeff Bezos chosen to start the company 170 miles to the south in Portland, the company would have paid a $10 licensing fee." They even refer to our minimum tax as a licensing fee. "One might wonder why Amazon came to Seattle in the first place. The big reason," Curry said, "is the area's large pool of technically savvy workers. Quote, we may be a retailer, but we succeed at retail because of the strength of our technology and innovation." That's what gets people to do business in Oregon. It's not our tax breaks. The super sales factor did not do anything to end the recession. And it also brings up the other big issue. Remember, we are just 1% of the national economy. 1%. And if the world economy, even smaller, and with our dependence and reliance upon high tech that's grown over the years, we felt that in 2001 with the downturn. And there's precious little decisions in the California legislature can affect us more, being larger than most other countries in the world, than the decisions by this legislature. You do have a lot of power, but you really cannot change our economy. We are at the total whim of the national economy in some large states like California and decisions in those states. And so, you know, they'll take tax breaks and they'll not pay taxes. But, you know, our economy did great, thank you. We had one of the best economies in the 1990s with our allegedly high income tax on capital gains. We have a low corporate tax burden. We have a tax shift away from businesses onto households, which the business activities tax that was proposed last session, I hope you'll continue to discuss that as a possibility, just as an alternative. We need to start getting more money out of the corporate side because we gave $60 million. This upcoming biennium, the super sales factor was projected to cost Oregon $60 million in the 2003-05 biennium. Went into effect January 1 of this year for tax years beginning May 2003. That's twice as much as we were going to get out of them under Measure 28. We need.
I'm guessing that revenue impact would be substantially less at this point, won't it, Paul?
Mr. Chair, we are in the process of reviewing our revenue impacts. We did in 01 for a number of things. And what we find is the base we assumed is at that time is a lot higher than what it's turned out to be. So we are going to do some revisions, and we're working with the Office of Economic Analysis to build those into the forecast. But the corporate base is, you know, our corporate revenue dropped by almost 50% last fiscal year. So,
Mr. Chairman, around the country, corporate taxes have gone down because companies have figured out how to avoid them, frankly. It's not just profits. I mean, if you look at sort of long-term trend, even prior to the recession or recession-adjusted, corporations have. So that's why New Jersey and other states are looking at New Jersey, and other states are looking at what do we do as a different way of getting the corporate tax revenues into our state. And in preserving the base, I think you ought to think about that and think about whether we need more. You know, in the research and development credit, you read the tax expenditure report, it doesn't recommend increasing the credit, expanding it beyond the limited number of things that are there and giving a 20-year carry forward. It has other questions about why it might not be working. But it's not the tax credit. You're just sort of rewarding already existing. You're probably just rewarding behavior that's going to happen anyway for those companies that are doing development. I'm not sure how that many are doing pure research in the sense of Bell Labs anymore.
You mentioned what we can do. Reading yesterday in the Governing Magazine about Wyoming and their tax system, I thought about, you know, this technology lateral drilling. We could drill a natural gas well in eastern Oregon and tap a field below Wyoming. We might get into the same kind of revenue system Wyoming's got.
First, you'll have to pass a severance tax on the Wyoming gas.
It could come up in Oregon. Anything else for Chuck? Very good stuff, Chuck. I appreciate your materials, too. Good information.
And I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll move on. We have a panel, I guess. Tim Nesbitt. Lori, are you going to give it a go? Okay. Lori Wimmer Whalen, Rich Peppers, and Ralph Groner. Lori will probably be a woman of few words this morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Who's first?
I thought I was
Rich,
doing the
over.
Go
here.
Ahead. All right. We're very well organized this morning. For the record, Mr. Chair, Rich Peppers with the Service Employees International Union, Local 503 OPEU. And as they speak, I'll let the other panelists introduce themselves. We want to thank the chair and the committee for giving us the opportunity to come up here and present our perspectives on the connection between tax policy and economic development as we see it. Each of the panelists will be presenting testimony on different aspects of this. Some overlap probably, as you saw. We're not totally organized.
They called it organized labor.
That's right. And my job is to start the presentation with a broad overview of our approach to this subject. But before I get started, we did see the testimony of the business folks, the business panel last week, and I just wanted to comment that there is some level of agreement between some of our perspectives. They mentioned, just about everybody who came forward mentioned, among other things, healthcare and energy costs as contributing factors for pressures on business budgets. And we certainly have a common concern here and are eager to work with people on ways to get a handle on those costs in ways that don't just shift the cost onto workers. And so we would extend an invitation to those folks to work together on that kind of a problem. But now onto the testimony we're here for. And even though we're addressing the Revenue Committee, we're here to say we don't view our tax structure, so long as it's in within the basic range, as being the primary determinant of whether our economy will expand. Obviously, there will be some examples that contradict this claim, but for businesses in general and for the economy as a whole, we believe tax policy is a second-level consideration in business location decisions. There will be more focus on this subject in later testimony, but the factors we'd like to stress to you are especially one that was mentioned in passing earlier on in some of the business locations decision. It has to do with the infrastructure that is the foundation for many of the businesses and business activity. Economic activity is associated with certain costs that are not easily borne by individual companies or by individuals, but are paid for through the pooled and public resources of a society acting collectively to tax itself and pay for those costs. For instance, we've heard a lot in this session and previous sessions about the need for improvements in our transportation system to move goods and people around the state, and we would agree that is a foundation for economic development. Other critical functions most people would likely agree upon include educating and training the upcoming workforce, keeping the population healthy and safe both at and away from work, intervening in or preventing crime, and generally protecting the quality of life that makes people want to live here and provides a platform for economic activity. These investments in a public infrastructure have the dual effect of providing a foundation for more economic growth, as I was just mentioning, as well as being a major economic driver in their own right, especially in rural Oregon and in small communities. As the current plan cuts and services play out, we believe there will be a bad ripple effect in many communities that will take its toll on the economy as well, the private economy as well. And we'll have more details and examples on this subject later on as well. Clearly, a balance must be struck between public and between private economic activity and the raising of adequate resources to fund the public infrastructure the economy needs. That balance is a matter of making societal trade-offs, which is, as you know, no easy task. And it's also not a scientific process. But we do believe the literature supports the contention that it's not the level of taxation in general that's significant in this respect, but it's the degree of stability, fairness, and predictability of the tax system that will make, that has a huger impact on economic and business location decisions. And in respect to the adequacy of Oregon's tax system, we believe we've been going in the wrong direction, the adequacy to fund a sound public infrastructure. LRO documents that the state and local tax burden as a share of personal income has declined from 10.6% to 9.6% in 1999. In response to the declining tax income, public budgets have become highly reliant on federal funds and fees of all sorts. But that kind of a revenue mix is not sustainable, as we're finding out. In our view, the declining commitment to our infrastructure is only partly a result of our current economic downturn. More central to this problem is a gradual erosion of the various available revenue sources, partly via the initiative system and partly through constant efforts to seek tax exemptions, credits, or just plain rate reductions. The usual rationale is that reductions in taxes will equate to more business and more jobs in the state. We believe the evidence in support of that proposition is scanty at best. An additional problem is that our long history of tax erosion creates inequities and distortions in the revenue system that breed public discontent and further pressures for more changes. But we'll have more testimony on this topic also. the high road, and there's a previous testimony in previous recessions that has talked about important forks in the road for Oregon, and they get characterized as the high road or the low road, and we agree with those assessments. On the low road, Oregon seeks to compete in the national and international markets on the basis of low-wage jobs and low costs for other factors of production. On the high road, Oregon seeks to attract and develop high-wage industries with many different strategies. Those include investing in providing a highly skilled workforce, collaborating where appropriate on research and development, conducting an analysis of industry clusters that feed into each other and support each other, and taking steps to act on what that analysis tells us. And you heard the example of Amazon.com earlier about their business location decisions having more to do with Seattle's situation than the tax structure in terms of the workforce. Tax credits and exemptions, if done right, can also be useful tools in economic development if agreements are reached and then enforced that ensure a good return in the form of highway jobs and other results for the public investment of forfeited revenues. Accountability for those agreements should then be a matter of public record. In this context, it's worth noting also the connection between economic development and the rules of international trade. Since Oregon must compete in the global marketplace, it is in our interest to make sure our trading partners are on a level playing field with us and that we seek to ensure our trading partners match us in labor and environmental standards. These are federal issues, of course, but Oregon can help to influence federal policies. In conclusion, we believe that economic development has a greater chance of succeeding with the supports of a quality public sector infrastructure. And in particular, if Oregon wishes to follow the high road strategy, it requires a strong commitment to public investment. We have been going in the wrong direction in that regard. Businesses would, we hope, support such a strategy and help return Oregon to a level of revenues that could support such a choice with a tax system that is predictable, adequate, and fair. As a first step, we would call on the Revenue Committee not to let revenue streams deteriorate any further than they already have, but we hope there will be a growing recognition that more is necessary and possible. And you heard testimony from Chuck already, and you'll hear more soon about ways that that could be accomplished.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. What I'd like to do maybe is go ahead and get the testimony from the panel in before we break for questions so we don't risk running out of time with anybody. Who's next? Tim?
I think I am. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. To summarize what I'm about to say, it's pretty simple, and that's that we need a more fair and adequate tax system to support the public investment and public services that are necessary to regain our economic footing and promote economic growth. In prior testimony last week, I think you heard a lot about taxes as a measure of business climate. By that measure, businesses in Oregon have nothing to complain about. We are now a low-tax state for business, the lowest of all 11 Western states. According to the Washington Alliance for a Competitive Economy and their 2003 Competitiveness Red Book, excerpt of which is attached in my prepared testimony, we now have the lowest share of state and local taxes paid by business and the lowest overall business tax burden in the West. And because we have a low business tax share, that means we have a high proportion of our taxes paid by individuals, by working families. And we saw this coming. Now, you've heard testimony like this from me over several sessions, over several years. In fact, over the past 12 years, we've been cutting and capping and eroding the major source of business support for public services, the property tax, about half of which is paid by business taxpayers, and relying more and more on state income taxes, of which more than 80% are paid by individuals. A 1997 study by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy described the consequence of this tax shift as follows. Oregon has chosen a tax structure in which households bear a higher percentage of the initial tax burden than do citizens of most states. As a result, Oregonians pay less in state and local public services, in state and local public services for each dollar in tax that they directly pay than do most Americans. This shift has also made our tax system less stable. We've decreased our reliance on a highly stable tax, the property tax, and become more dependent on the income tax, which is much more volatile. And finally, the reduction in tax effort on the business side has made our tax system less able to support the services we need to educate our children, keep our communities safe, maintain our roads and bridges, and care for the sick and elderly. So our bottom line findings, and having gone over all these studies over the last several years, is that clearly working families are paying more in taxes but getting less in services, which I think tells us a lot about the uphill battle we had in trying to pass Measure 28. Secondly, we have the highest rate of hunger and unemployment in the U.S. At the same time, our safety net is fraying. We have the shortest school year in the country, when we need to be preparing our children for the jobs of a new knowledge-based economy. And our bridges are crumbling and our roads are in disrepair at a time when a first-rate transportation system is a prerequisite for economic development in a trade-dependent economy. So business taxpayers have won the sprint to the bottom. They can now brag about the lowest tax rates in the West. But we have few resources left for the longer-term challenge of creating and sustaining family wage jobs in a competitive global economy. We should realize that now that we'll never regain our economic footing with part-time schools and part-time services and a deteriorating infrastructure. I think some of that is coming to fruition in reports I've heard from the governor's office about some businesses which were recruited, which were being recruited, and have now called to say that they're not coming. I think we can get more detail on that in the next week. So we have two directions to recommend to restore the funding we need to invest in our future and grow our economy. First, don't be seduced by the argument that we need a sales tax or a three-legged tax system to produce stable revenues. We don't. Sales taxes are no more stable than income taxes. Witness what Washington and California are going through right now. And if you try to substitute a sales tax, which is not deductible from federal taxes, for a portion of the income tax or the property tax, both of which are deductible, you'd be forced to raise at least $1.03 in new taxes for every dollar in replaced taxes just to remain revenue neutral. We think we can walk, even run, just as easily with a two-legged tax system if we strengthen those legs to do the job they were designed to do. But we will need to restore some balance between the tax effort of businesses and individuals and make sure we save a little in good times to make up for shortfalls in bad times. So our second point is strengthen the two legs of our tax system. This can be done in two ways, by raising tax rates and by restoring the tax base. We believe it's only fair that businesses pay the same tax rate on their profits that workers pay on their wages. And it's only fair that a small business, most of which are S-corps and partnerships and sole proprietorships, pay the same tax rates on their profits as a large corporation. By equalizing the corporate income tax rate with the personal income tax rate at 5, 7, and 9%, we would raise approximately $230 million in the next biennium. And only a business that earns a profit would pay that tax. Also, the Oregon tax incidence model, I want to remind you, tells us that the corporate income tax has the least negative impact on jobs, the least effect on low-wage workers, and the greatest potential for exporting our tax burden to out-of-state taxpayers. Another option on the tax rate side is to establish a statewide property tax on non-owner-occupied residential property. A tax rate of $3 per thousand on such property would raise approximately $645 million in the next biennium. It can be dedicated to schools and easily applied to your statewide funding formula for schools. It would add stability to our tax system and restore business support for the education of our future workforce. And finally, there's the obvious need to restore our income and property tax bases by eliminating and limiting tax credits, exclusions, and other forms of preferential treatment, which we call tax expenditures. Tax expenditures are growing out of all proportion to state and local budgets in Oregon. Between 1997-99 and 2001-03, total state and local tax expenditures grew by 27%. In the same period, state and local tax collections grew by 15%. We give back more in tax breaks than we collect in tax revenues. In 1999-01, Oregon and its local governments collected approximately 46 cents for every dollar levied in taxes. In the current biennium, that number declined to 42 cents. Another way of saying this, for every dollar we levy in taxes, we collect only 42 cents. Another 50 cents is given back in the form of tax breaks. Now, if the tax expenditures had held constant as a percentage of total taxes levied between 99-01 and 01-03, the state and local governments would have collected an additional $1.4 billion in tax revenue in the current biennium if we had just held tax expenditures to the same proportion of taxes levied in the prior biennium. So we believe it's time to reexamine all tax breaks and repeal those that aren't cost-effective in achieving good public policy purposes. What are those purposes? From our review of the tax expenditure report, we would offer this initial list of criteria. Those that promote education, fight poverty and hunger, promote home ownership and affordable housing, promote child welfare, promote access to health care, help workers save for retirement, and promote economic development and job creation. Now, once we've accepted, and you may have a better list, that's our initial list, but once we've accepted the purpose and the criteria for tax breaks, we should also hold them accountable to a strict standard of cost effectiveness. And for all tax breaks that purport to achieve economic development, we should ask for outcomes in terms of good jobs produced and sustained at a reasonable cost. For example, property tax breaks for agriculture will cost $268 million in the next biennium. Actually, property and income tax breaks combined. We have a list attached. And that's compared to 54,200 jobs in that sector, including all self-employed individuals. That's an average cost of about $2,500 per job per year, not for jobs created so much as jobs sustained. Now, this might be reasonable. We don't know. You should look, we believe, at the cost of these business tax breaks one by one in every industry in terms of the dollars per job and dollars lost to state and local governments that could otherwise be spent on services. Now, you're certain to hear the siren song of business advocates asking for more and bigger tax breaks for economic development that started last week. And as you know, the song they sing is always about jobs. So ask those who advocate more tax breaks to show you the jobs and show you the money. How many jobs are promised and at what cost? And once you have those numbers, ask yourselves if that's a reasonable cost or if the money can be better spent elsewhere, because the needs elsewhere are compelling. We'll have a list for you next week. It's still being vetted by the Department of Administrative Services. But when you're looking at cost impacts of a million here or a million there, just remember that for $1 million, you could fund prison time for 39 inmates for a year. You could fund a day of classroom time for 53,000 students, or educate 143 students year-round in Oregon, or providing home care for 160 seniors. We will call your attention to those kinds of impacts with just $1 million whenever advocates come before you for any new tax breaks. And again, when it comes to the threat to our economic future, we don't believe it's higher taxes. It's the lack of resources, as Rich just told you, to support the services we need to be competitive in a knowledge-based, fast-paced global economy. So please keep this in mind as we work to rebuild our economy and provide good jobs for Oregonians, because we're not going to get there with part-time schools and cracked and roads that are in disrepair and bridges that are cracked and courts that are open 4 days a week.
Okay. Thank you. I have just one question on your, make sure I just understand your testimony, Tim. On the third page, you refer here to the tax of $3 per thousand on non-owner-occupied residential property. I'm not sure where the modifier works there. That's all property that's not owner-occupied residential property?
That's right.
Okay.
Commercial, industrial, and everything else on the rolls.
Okay.
Second homes included.
Okay, thank you. Lori.
I'm going to try this. Excuse me for my laryngitis. Actually, it's not laryngitis. It's a ploy for your sympathies. For the record, I'm Lori Wimmer-Waitland with the Oregon Education Association, representing our 45,000 members statewide. And you have for me three handouts, and that'll aid us today. My written testimony, which I will just summarize, as well as a report on basically the question that Representative Barnhart asked with respect to the effect of tax expenditures on business investment. And finally, a report that we commissioned along with COSA and OSBA with respect to Oregon education's impact on local economies. What I'd like to talk with you about today is how public education impacts Oregon's economic situation in two ways, both at the Main Street level, the local business level, and also the corporate level. Our commission study by Eco Northwest last spring reflected that K-12 spending supports significant economic activity in the state, not just through the direct spending on job creation and education-related services and supplies, but also indirectly to the private market. And you will see in that study a very detailed analysis, but for the 2000-2001 school year, which they studied, the statewide impact was that the spending by K-12 in Oregon's 198 school districts resulted in a total of 107,000 jobs directly or indirectly impacted and $3.93 billion worth of personal income for the state citizenry. And, of course, the taxes that those citizens pay also impact the ability of the state to sustain its programs. 51,000 of those jobs were directly to K-12 employees, but the fact that what they found was that approximately 9 private sector jobs are supported for every 10 school employees. So that's a pretty good ratio. We found this was especially pronounced, this link, in rural economies, probably no surprise to all of you, particularly in eastern Oregon. The example I'll raise for your consideration, they found that approximately 6,500 jobs were directly impacted by K-12 spending and $200 million in personal income that year, which is 12.1% of employment and 9.2%. I got backwards, 9.2% of employment and 12.1% of total income for that region. And in a region with, I would argue, high unemployment and low wages, that's a significant stimulus to that local economy. As you heard in last week's testimony by the business panel, public education is also vital to corporate Oregon. That's true with respect to creating a well-educated, well-trained workforce. It's also true with respect to being a draw for those folks who are knowledge workers coming from other states to Oregon who want good schools for their families. And it's also true with our community college system, who are your rapid response team to retool and retrain workers in downturns such as the one we're in right now. The support that public education as one of your infrastructure investments provides to economic recovery is so important that we believe that this legislature ought to re-energize its commitment to preserving and enhancing that asset as a part of its economic development strategy. The job before this committee is very tough, and we appreciate that, and thank you for having us here and hearing our words, or half hearing them anyway. We believe that this is a very difficult subject that you're grappling with, and it will require some courage because of the variance of opinions in the public opinion and in this building as well. But we think that without not only remedying the local the current business cycle and also the more systemic problems that contribute to the impact the recession has had specifically in Oregon, we will be doomed to repeat it at increasingly more dramatic levels in the future. We'd like this committee to consider several points about that with respect to that issue. First of all, tax expenditures. As you've heard from several of those who've spoken before me, Oregon gives away in tax breaks about 58 cents for every tax dollar it levies in the current tax expenditures. Now, I know that about 100 bills that have come through that are related to revenue that I've been tracking in the last 3 weeks, the vast majority of those would ask you to enact new tax expenditures that further diminish the tax base and further deplete the revenues at a time when we can least afford to play Santa Claus. It only takes a simple majority to say yes to those kind of proposals, but as you all know, it takes supermajority of each chamber to pass tax increase, and generally also means going back to the ballot, which is a phenomenal effort for all of us. So we would ask you first, do no harm as so many others have, and not necessarily be quite as willing to see and take on faith the notion that tax expenditures and economic stability or stimulus are inextricably linked. The data just don't bear that out. And that's why I've given you that little report I did on the linkage and some of the pushback on the contention without data that you've been hearing so often, that there is irrefutably necessarily a link to job creation and economic growth. If you give tax breaks to certain industries, it seems that that's not always supported by the data. Growing our way out, the other thing I hear most commonly in this building is that we don't need to create new revenue or a better tax system. We need just to hold the line and grow our way out. Again, the tax breaks argument follows this line, that if you give those inducements, that we will in fact grow our way out. But the math just doesn't bear that out. In our best year, our very peak year, the economy, according to legislative revenue, was 95, 97, that was it. And the growth rate after you adjust for the kicker was 23%. We're nowhere near growing our way out. A projected growth of between 10 and 14%. Plus, you have to add back the inflation for all the years we've been cutting recently. You have to add the cost of doing what we'd like to do, particularly with respect to public education. If we were to fund our ambition, our legislated statutory standards for K-12, as described by the quality education model, we would be funding K-12. At the 2003-05 rate, $7 billion. Well, the governor's budget, of course, is $2 billion below that. So we have a lot of catching up to do, and we're not likely to see 23% growth rates anytime soon. So I would suggest that it would be common sense math to reject the notion that we can just grow our way out. And finally, with respect to comprehensive tax reform, as I mentioned earlier, we believe the recession is part of the problem, but not the only part of the problem. We believe that the system needs some changing, that a revenue problem demands a revenue solution. You've heard me say that 100 times, I'm sure. We also believe that tax reform can't wait. There are those in this building with which we respectfully disagree that we should wait a biennium and come back in some later date after the blood has flowed in the streets. Our governments don't have the time to wait. We believe that we need a remedy now. We also believe there are other things that you can do that would be helpful in these times, and some of those have also been touched upon by others: retiring some of the tax expenditures in current law, resisting the pressure to pass new tax breaks, and repealing the rolling reconnect before Congress cuts taxes more. We believe that if the issue you're studying is protracted period of revenue shortfalls, the answer is tax reform and full funding for K-12 as an economic driver in the state. We believe if the issue is jobs, the answer is public education as well. If the issue is revitalizing Oregon's communities one by one, the answer is again public education. If the issue is global competitiveness, the answer is public education. If the issue is economic recovery statewide, the answer is public education. Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. Let's go on to Ralph, and then we'll ask some questions to the panel.
Well, I got to be able to see my deal. Somehow, Laura and I both got this frog in our throat, and I don't know if that was some kind of thing that was.
I didn't do it.
Yeah, no, I was. No, I wanted to know. For the record, boy, I can speak. My name is Ralph Groner. I represent AskMe, and I want to thank Paul Warner for inviting me to this because, truthfully, I know all three of these folks, and they are all very, very bright, and I am more plebeian by nature. I think it's that Paul's been at workshops with me, and I'm not going to speak on the kinds of things I do at those tax workshops with him. I will show, if you don't mind, more my local government background as it deals with economic development, since I spent 8 years as county commissioner and still have my strong leanings in that area. I also would like to say that I remember getting in trouble. I'm so happy you're smiling. I came in as a rookie lobbyist on the same topic that Tim Nesbitt just testified to. I did a beautiful job of writing a speech called Down the Hall. And some still are laughing about that, because Down the Hall in 91, where all of these programs were going wanting, each and every budget, and in the Revenue Committee we were giving exemptions away, and I made a big issue of that, and I came on wrong. And the result was I made some enemies on the committee. So those who are still mad at me that are now gone, I apologize. I've learned to change my style as a result of it, and I think that maybe I've somehow accomplished more. But that's where I first got kicked in the teeth, because I did the same thing the same research, made the same statement, and had legislators from the committee who were mad at me. So I want to say right up front, we're not here to anger anyone. We're just here to offer ideas and suggestions and alternative points of view. One, I want to say rather quickly so we can get through my testimony, to be careful of one. If you hear something you think belongs in another committee, it doesn't matter to me, because quite frankly, I think the committee chairs, when they're dealing with economic development, transportation, revenue, etc., probably need to meet regularly, if you're not already, to talk about concerted effort on how to get the economy moving. So mine would be some minor things. One of the things, having grown up in county government, I'm concerned with, having been a commissioner at the time, our assessors who were out of tune, to the tune of getting property on the rolls, we fell behind sometimes 10 years. And what that meant to K through 12, and what that meant to sit above and beyond what the law allowed, believe me. And I can tell you that you fixed that in part in the legislature with the fees. However, I would suggest that under Measure 50, where property is now allowed to come on the rolls immediately rather than a delay, that assessors are now being cut in this state. And once again, we're going to face the same problem with the reductions coming in because they're general fund. And to the extent that mental health and human services are being reduced by the state, it in fact means cuts countywide in all of our counties. If in fact we get into those staff that make sure the property is on the roll in a timely fashion, I just want to say it's going to adversely affect education and other public services. I want to make that point. Two, public works we've talked about, but I want to say I testified many times in front of the Transportation Commission on bridges, so I won't dwell on it. But I think that it's far more than bridges. I want to offer a suggestion that Oregon look at what's called economic development corridors. I'm aware of at least five of them. One of them's Coos Bay. Another one in Clackamas County is the Sunrise Corridor. We cannot talk about creating new jobs and businesses if, in fact, we do not have economic corridors that adequately get the trucks and the transportation from those factories back onto our freeway system. And we're not going to be able to fund them with gas tax and bonds. So my suggestion is, Oregon, look at tolls to fund the five or six economic development corridors and make sure that that's exactly what they are, that they open up the economy for that area. Revenue need, why? I only want to add one other reason. When I said in 91 I went down the hall, and I work a lot of budgets for my union, but I also work revenue for 30 years. And the fact of the matter is that I saw what Measure 5 was doing to our budgets at that time. And I only want to say what I say at the workshops, one part of it. And that is that under Measure 5, we currently are losing over one, someone don't like the word loss. So I apologize to you. But revenue that's property revenue that's gone because of Measure 5 is over $1 billion per year. Add to that Measure 50, it's over $1 billion per year. That's $2 billion per year, $4 billion a biennium in property tax revenue that's no longer there. Lori made the point that we need to have adequate revenue, and I'm with her on this issue and everyone else that talks about it. We have been required to put out $3.47 billion, that is the actual, according to legislative fiscal, the amount that we wouldn't have been required to if Measure 5 hadn't passed. But I'm afraid with Measure 50, as the cap continues and we're losing that amount of money, what happens because we mix in this pot the equalization when the property revenue continues to decline as it is, and that means more dependence on the income tax. Another thought I would hope you would like is that this is a nice one for you and a fun one. I would hope you would draft a little memorial out of this committee that says to Congress and to America that let's put Americans to Work Memorial to Congress that says, you know, rather than $300 billion that goes for dividends or for the wealthiest. And by the way, I love them, wealthy people, don't we all? We do. We love each of us. I don't know many myself, but I personally don't have a problem with wealthy people. Some have invited me to the homes. I've never been invited back, but I can tell you. But I absolutely have no problem with it. But I honestly believe this from the bottom of my heart that if America would take $300 billion out of the $674 billion that the president's talking about and put people to work to fix our bridges, our dams, our highways, and our terrible broken infrastructure in this country, fishways, name something, it's broke. The fact is you would have put people to work with family wage jobs, putting money back into the federal coffer, the state coffer, and reduced the national deficit. And I just read the headlines. It's the largest deficit ever. We can't continue. And Oregon was a leader years ago, and I would hope you'd be a leader and be the first state to say, hold it, hold it, and memorialize Congress. Let's put people to work, and rather than take money and continue to give it to that one group I'm not part of who will probably bank it, and rather than go out and spend it, which is what we want workers to do. And I don't mean on beer. I'm talking about spending on TVs and stereos and computers and the kinds of things worker bees now do. Exemptions they've talked about wonderfully. All I have to say from a plebeian point of view, life's a balance to me. I'm older than these folks. Frankly, you get testimony in front of you and it's good. Testimony's good. But you gotta kind of step back and have a sense of common sense, which comes from your experience, which you all have, and say, hold it. If we're gonna have these exemptions, it seems to me that Tim talked about and Lori, the justification, but I'd be willing to vote. If somebody said, okay, if we have these following exemptions, let's say $1 billion worth, go to a vote of the public. Your vote saying abolish those means you either keep them, these exemptions, or it means kids in school, it means state police, and it means Oregon's most vulnerable citizens get their medication and they aren't kicked out of their assisted living. Okay? I'm one who bets on that one passing. Compared to Measure 28. But I lose on every one of these, so don't listen to that. So I would also say that we need to do something. Oh, I forgot on public works, I'm sorry, not to just talk about bridges. We're in trouble on our maintenance at the city and county level. So I wrote that down. Preservation, and we've got maintenance and preservation, which should come through the gas tax increase we need desperately. We haven't had that, as you know, since 91. Bonds are going for the bridges, the governor's proposal, to be very clear. And so that's economic development. But I also talked to my friends from local government, and road maintenance gets jobs more evenly distributed to rural and urban than other funds do, and a lot of the money is contracted out, asphalt overlays. The permanent jobs also help the local economy, but you know, we buy aggregate, that's rock, asphalt. I was just having fun on that. I looked at you, Phil. Oil, equipment parts, fuel from local vendors. So when we talk maintenance, which I don't need to talk to former mayors and local government folks here, it's in a state of disrepair. We can't really talk about economic development and just fixing bridges because you're going to fall into the brink without saying, folks, those trucks have to be able to get to that freeway without the bridges on our highways, and it's a lot cheaper to fix them today than let them continue in a state of disrepair and say, oh, my God, someday we're going to fix them. By the way, we've done that since 91. So we do need to do that. I would like to see industrial lands everyone talks about. We desperately need to talk about industrial lands, but in new construction and bringing in industrial lands and everyone getting behind that, we're short. We're terribly short. My only comment to folks is Clackamas County causes most of the air pollution in the Tri-County area. I'm from there. 72% of our people commute out of Clackamas County to work in Multnomah and in Washington County. They're an example of where we have this imbalance. The jobs are in Hillsborough, Gresham. Our folks are going to the jobs, driving their car, and the fact is we haven't been able to keep up with it, and congestion. We need industrial lands, and once we get that industrial land, we need to streamline the process, so I'll give you an exact idea. One of the problems we have at the local level, if somebody does want to come to a county and talk to the governor about it, is contrary to what we think, oftentimes we don't have enough planners to get that job done. Cities, counties. We're not up to it because we haven't had the funds. So one of the things I hope folks will look at is using some of the lottery money for industrial development. If they need emergency planner help, we should have a pool of that that can come in and help local government. The streamlining the permit process. Everyone I talk to, I'm on the streamlining commission, so we're working on that. But we also would like you to know that if we're going to have an industrial lands inventory, then we have to make sure that we can get that job done in a timely fashion, and there's a way to do it. Rather than each division in each county taking a new approach each time your planning process kicks in, we have to go to each segment of that, and it takes time. One person. Let's call it a one-person walkthrough for industrial development. One person should be assigned that from building codes, and that person should walk that process through so that plans review starts from the beginning with the permit and moves right along, so that rather than the plans review being done at the end, which takes a lot of time, which is money, you in fact have brought the two together, and you're going to have, it's going to take more staff. No doubt about it. Because we've got to have somebody at the local level who can follow that process through the various processes. And usually land use is the part that gets it caught up. But we could get some of that done earlier in the stage. And last, I probably left out everything I wanted to say, but last, most important to, well, I want to thank SEIU because they got a grant. Most important issue to me personally, after, about 5 years now and several hundred seminars, I've learned more than I teach. And that is, I've learned the citizens of Oregon really are voting no on almost anything we send them, primarily because they really, truly do not understand the basics of this system, where the tax dollars come from, where they go, what the ballot measures have cattywambused the budget have done, and when you teach that simple and easy to understand, they begin changing. So, Citizens for Oregon's Future, just a minute, cough, has begun, and nonpartisan, business, labor, churches, citizen groups emanating from the public, hired a director, hiring some other staff. The process is underway to teach 200,000 Oregonians the tax system and how it works. We would appreciate not only your endorsement, your support, because if we do not, and I found that CEOs knew less about this in chambers. I've been in front of all of them, and they honestly do not know the basics. And once you learn the basics and understand the facts as they actually are, right from Paul Warner, and we all trust Paul, don't we? Yeah, Bob does. Shipwreck trust Paul. We all do. So once so my ending shot is educate, educate, educate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right, I appreciate the challenging testimony of the panel, but also your thoughtful testimony and materials that left with us. We have some time for questions, committee. Comments, reflections, questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Cox.
Thank you. I guess, Tim, I know we've talked about this approach at one of our favorite subjects, loopholes, tax breaks. But we struggled with how to go about taking on one at a time, all at one, having an independent military base closure commission take these on, and I just wondered what you thought of the base closure idea.
Mr. Chair and Representative Haas, I guess our recommendation would be to, if you're going to try and come up with a package of proposals, to start with some principles. We gave you our idea for an initial list of criteria that I think would be easy to get agreement on to say this is a good reason to have a tax break in the first place. And then secondly, I don't know if this lends itself to the packaging as much, but a way to basically test the cost effectiveness. It may be that a particular tax break does create new jobs, but at what cost? And you apply those kinds of critiques to expenditures. You go over the budget very carefully in terms of what you get for your dollars. We think you should apply the same thinking, the same critical thinking, to tax expenditures, because on the surface they all look superficially good, or you wouldn't have adopted them, but they need to be tested further. They may make sense at one time, they don't make sense now, they may have been cost effective at one time and not now. It's that kind of a cost effective analysis which we think is a little tougher to do, but that's the approach. And if you end up with a package at the end of ones that don't pass, fine. That's, but I just think it's cost effectiveness piece that has to be looked at.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's an excellent idea if you set up a just, you know, four or five standards, how many jobs does this actually make, and put all of these up against a scorecard, that is really a good approach. I just think the people in this state would be outraged if they knew that we spend more on tax breaks in this state than we do on services. And so I think that's an interesting way to look at doing this. So thanks.
Thank you.
Other comments, questions? One thing I had, I guess, Tim, you said prescription was with regard to our tax structure, strengthening our two-legged system. Or I heard you prescribe comprehensive tax reform. Am I hearing the same thing, or are you two speaking about different things here? It sounds to me like strengthening the two-legged system really isn't comprehensive reform. That's dealing with tax credits. That's dealing with rates. That's dealing with, you know, the system that we have. Lori, what I hear usually when someone says comprehensive tax reform in this room, that's code word for sales tax or something like that. And so I guess that's what I'm trying to ask. Am I hearing the same thing from you or not?
I think comprehensive reform can be achieved without a third tax, sales tax, gross receipts tax, if we truly rejuvenate our tax system so that we get the revenue we need from a growing economy to continue to reinvest in, you know the rest of the script.
Okay.
I don't think it necessarily means, it could mean a new tax, but remember the warnings we've had from prior testimony in prior years that when you really do add a new tax to the system and you're trying to, you know, adjust here and adjust there, you create winners and losers, and losers are always a lot more angry than the winners are grateful. And that's why the comprehensive package that involves trying to integrate a new tax into our system is such a daunting task.
And maybe then, Lori, what do you mean by comprehensive tax reform?
Mr. Chair, I echo what Tim says, but I don't necessarily, on behalf of OEA,
no.
We have not specifically adopted a particular favorite tax strategy. We believe that we're pragmatists, frankly. We want to see a system-wide change that meets the principles of fairness, adequacy, and stability, and however that's best achieved, balanced against political reality, I guess I would say. You can have the ideal tax system, but if it can't pass public muster, then you've got nothing. So we are also hopeful that whatever might be able to move would be something we could support. And so it's a vaguer answer than I think you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not specifically advocating for a particular tax like the sales tax, gross receipts tax, or whatever. We think all of those ought to be on the table for discussion. And, you know, in the ideal world, my dream would be that you would all pass out a revision, because a revision is Armada proof. And then you could do something a little bit more comprehensive than silver bullet one new tax kind of deal, and I think that would be able to mollify, if you will, certain segments of the population who might not otherwise be willing to go there with us, but I think that I would leave that to your greater wisdom as a committee to determine that balancing act.
All right, Representative Virgil.
Yes, my question is for Tim. Tim, let's say that we want to cite a mill in Coos Bay, and it would be in an enterprise zone, which, as you know, protects them for 3 years for taxes. But as a part of all of that, they are required to have, in other words, the whole layout for you of how many jobs they're going to have and what those jobs are going to pay and so forth. So you're really not talking about that kind of thing, I don't think.
Mr. Chair and Representative Virgil, actually, that's probably the best example of how to negotiate a tax break and get something quantified and deliverable in return. I think a better example is the strategic investment program, where county commissions actually negotiate project by project with employers and get certain guarantees as to the number of jobs created and the quality of the jobs created. That is the model we do support. If the test for an economic development incentive is good jobs, that's the way it should be done.
Let me use another example. The mill's going to be there. There'll be about a $50 million investment. So the owner of the mill comes and wants some assistance, some type of tax assistance, something, to be able to get started. going to hire 125 men, probably 50 management positions and so forth. Again, we're tying accountability to the assistants. And so, again, that gets the Good Housekeeping stamp of approval. Is that right?
The approach certainly does. We would probably have additional criteria to look at. We would want to make sure those are good jobs with good benefits, family-based jobs. We'd like to see employers commit to not opposing their workers and their choice to have a union and voice on the job. We might have a longer list of criteria than is usually enacted, but that approach is something we strongly endorse.
There would be other discussions. I think our problem is, in that dialogue, is that the person has the capability through the banking system to get a tremendous amount of money, but they, of course, are at risk. And so if we give them no help, no assistance, demand too much, come in and are overregulated, the $50 million has a lot of places to go besides Oregon and certainly besides Coos Bay. So the more difficult you make it at some point, and I'm not talking about reasonableness, but if you go too far, the person says, I'll go talk to my bankers, and we never see them again.
And I think,
and we've lost
Representative, that's why we need a systematic approach, because we should also be talking about the workforce development side of things and the kind of workers who can be made available locally through community college training and other kinds of workforce assistance. So it's always a package and it's always a balance. That's right.
Richard, I need to wrap this up.
Well, I was just going to add to that it's another reason why looking both in-state, nationally, and internationally to try and create more of a level playing field so communities don't get whipsawed against each other for a spiraling downhill trip to the lowest, who can bid the most in tax expenditures, but working to have a common system across the state and hopefully eventually beyond that, too. That would be another goal to strive for.
All right. Any other final comments? I've got a meeting at 10:30 that I need to get to. Did you?
Yeah. I was just going to say that, Mr. Chair, the COF initiative, Mr. Groner, I would like to clone you and send you out coughing. But I will tell you, I'm admiring that you're doing it. I've spent 3 weeks here sitting listening to tax issues, and I haven't glazed the surface of understanding the tax situation in Oregon. So I admire you for trying to go out, simplify it, and explain it to Oregonians, and I hope that you are very successful in that effort and would applaud that, because we need a lot of help in explaining to Oregonians what we do here.
It is true that the budget and revenue issues are not rocket science, but they are more complicated than most people comprehend until you get into the details. That is part of our job, too, to help educate. So thank you for your efforts. I wish we could go on. This is very engaging, but we are out of time. I thank you for your testimony today, and coupled with the testimony we got last week, I think it gave us a pretty broad perspective on these issues. Now we'll see what we can do as the session goes on. Thank you, everyone. We are adjourned until 8:30 Monday morning. We have some bills before us, so do your homework over the weekend.
A minor and a major one.
A minor and a major one. All right. Adjourned.